Okay, welcome to the Witterings Fitness Podcast. Today we have Tom Petch, national treasure, and Witterings Fitness member, Tom Petch, who has just released a book about the history of the SAS called Speed Aggression Surprise. And we are recording this on the eve of me going to Cambodia, and I was talking to Tom about Cambodia and his history. And he actually has been to Cambodia, and he's going to talk to us about that. We've also got Rory here for backup, asking questions in case I run out of ideas.
I have also been to Cambodia.
You've also been to Cambodia.
Well done, Rory. I haven't written a book.
haven't you not written a book? I'm surprised, Rory.
Not yet, Tom.
Rory's got a book in him, definitely.
Yeah. Definitely. So, yeah, could you, Tom, just tell us about your history. Obviously, you're ex-military man as well, so...
Yeah, so really briefly, I went to Cambodia in, it must have been 1992, 93, because at that point Cambodia was a closed country, and I was part of a military mission there to carry out the first free elections in the country. And it was an extraordinary experience. Most of the country was dominated by guerrilla warfare, Khmer Rouge, who were not very friendly people. In fact, they had a genocide out there. And so, yeah, some of the places I went, I was probably the first guy to Westerner to walk into for since the 1970s. And this was in 1990, so 20 odd years. It will now be completely changed when you get there.
Yeah. I should have said, I'm actually cycling for a charity out there. So raising money for a charity called Reach. So it's a school.
Yeah.
I think when I went to the museum, that covered the what happened in the genocide. I think as a Westerner, when you go there and you go to the museum, you don't appreciate the size and the scale of what went on, because I'm not sure the media coverage at the time was all that extensive over here, and it gets overlooked in the context of the Vietnam War and other things in the region, doesn't it?
Yeah, it was called Sideshow. In fact, there's a book called Sideshow, because it was the thing that, because the North Vietnamese were coming through there to get into Vietnam, it wasn't actually even on the chart. And in fact, Watergate and Nixon and all that came about because he was hiding the fact he was bombing Cambodia. But if you went there, when you went there, were they excavating the pits? Did you see the skulls and stuff?
They were excavating the pits. They created a tower out of the skulls, actually. So they had a glass tower.
Yeah,
filled with skulls, and you walked through a central staircase with the skulls all around you in this glass tower.
I mean,
and the pits that they were excavating were all around. And
yeah, I mean, did you walk out into the fields, the killing fields?
Well, you could, and only on certain paths, because there's a lot of landmines still there, aren't there?
Yeah, when we got there, they started excavating that, and we went out there, me and a couple of other guys. This is when we first arrived, just because we wanted to see it, because we knew they'd started looking into the mass killings. Right. So long story short, 1 million people were killed out of a population of 3. It was horrific. And we walked out there. I remember that day it was raining.
Out of a population of 3 million?
About a third of the population died in a genocide.
Is it not the greatest in terms of loss of life,
the greatest
genocide in history, I think
it traumatized that country, you know. It really did. People were really, obviously, you know, affected them massively. When we got there, being close to the Western world, because it had a Vietnamese backed government which the US would recognize, and we went, the first thing we did when we went to Phnom Penh pretty much was go and look at the killing fields, because they started excavating, but we could walk out into them. And we started walking out with this guide, like, through the pits where they were pulling bodies, well, not bodies, but skulls out and stuff. And then I realised we were walking on human remains. It was unbelievable what happened there.
Yeah, and you went out there in what date, what year?
92. So we were there.
89 when it all kind of finished, was it?
Yeah, well, no, the war was still going on. So this is really complicated, but basically the Vietnamese invaded Cambodia to get rid of the Khmer Rouge. They did a good thing there, but because it was the Vietnamese army and they'd been fighting the Yanks, the UN wouldn't recognise them because America vetoed it. So we went in so that they could have an election, and whatever government came out of that would be recognised at the UN, which is what happened.
Right.
So we had the first elections in the country, which were pretty amazing, actually. We had, I remember there was a team of students who went out to the country to try and explain what an election was, because nobody knew that in the villages. And I remember the morning, and the Cambridge said, no, we're going to blow up all the election sites. So on the morning of the election, me and my interpreter went out to the first election site thing. And there'd been a thunderstorm the night before. It was raining all night. And I just thought, this is going to be such a fight in the morning, because they could, the Cambridge were good at blowing things up, basically putting mines and stuff. And we drove out in the morning rain, looked over the paddy fields, and there were thousands of people walking across the paddies to the election site. And I thought, Cambridge can't touch this. 90% of the population is voting because they're fed up with this shit. Pardon my French, my last ones. Yeah. They're fed up with this.
Fuck it.
And there's no way the Cambridge could touch them. I always say that. When someone says, oh, don't vote, I go, well, you know, that's because you've lived in a democracy. If you haven't, you'd vote.
Yeah. Incredible.
Yeah.
Well, so it's really like fresh in people's minds then.
Yeah.
How we've talked, Tom, haven't we, before about management of trauma. I mean, we were talking just yesterday about setting up you setting up a men's group in the Witterings, not just for people who have experienced horrific trauma, but just for people to talk about their problems. But I wonder, when you were going to places like that in the military and you would see horrific things, I'm sure things that you won't go into detail about here, but how have you dealt with that over the years? You know, how have you processed that?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something that we don't, and this is why I was thinking, talking to you about this idea of doing a men's group. I think that's become a more criminal, and it is a men's group, because I think men don't talk about this stuff. And you know, if you go back into your 20s, basically when you're in your 20s, you think you're indestructible, don't you? You know, but especially if you're doing like physical things, exercise in the military, you've got a good mindset there for doing that stuff. But I think the things that affect you, I think of it like you're running an overdraft. You keep clocking stuff up. It's going to come home to roost at some point. For a lot of people in the military, that comes home to roost when they leave, because they come off this treadmill and then they go into society and they're suddenly cut free from their support network and where they'd be able to be with their other mates who are in the military. And I think that's a thing people know now, that actually people who've been in the military come out, often have huge problems, you know. I'll be honest, I had my own sort of issues a long time ago with that. Well, Rory might disagree. Maybe I've got some issues in the gym. But the gym's a good place to work issues out. Let's face it, for men, exercise is a really good therapeutic thing. And talking to other men, because men don't talk about stuff. And I was just thinking, because I was having a coffee with a couple of mates the other day, and I just thought, this is really good, just sitting down. And, you know, everyone's got their issues. Their issues about, you know, whatever, car insurance, kids not sleeping, whatever the issues are, it's good just to share that.
Mm. And having a space to do it, which you get, I guess, when you leave the military, you lose, don't you? Yeah.
You do, and I think there's also a thing there where, and I think this is a thing, often men do things around drinking. I hate to say this, go to the pub.
Mm.
Alcohol's not the best place to do it, you know.
But it's being in the pub with your mates.
It's being in the pub with your mates is important, but adding the alcohol to it, alcohol's as depressive as we know. And I think people do use alcohol, particularly men. And talking about my own experience with the military, that's a big deal. You know, you must know that from your own experiences.
Yeah. I don't feel like there was a lot. I mean, there wasn't a lot of support or education around managing stress when I was in. And I was in a lot more recently than you.
And you were in Afghanistan, weren't you?
And I was in Afghanistan.
Which is pretty rough.
In Iraq, right? You know, there was a little bit we had... We had sort of first responders. Can't remember what they called them now, but did you have that? Probably not.
No.
Like mental health first responders.
We didn't have anything.
Didn't even know what mental health was.
What are you doing talking about that? You weak man.
You weak man.
Well, that as the non-military man in the room, that's my perception of it, is that you might have discussed things and it was probably over several pints, but it would have been in quite... And you can correct me, but in quite a sort of egoic way, or it'd have been very piss-takey, and there'd have been, you wouldn't have necessarily got to the root cause of what was bothering the problem, bothering the person, rather.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's true, but I think that's true of men generally. I think men do that. You know, you don't want to open up about your problems. Tend to tough it out. Tend to get quiet about it.
I mean, it was clear to me, like the people, you know, the guys who'd been in the army for a long time, you know, they. It was about 50%, probably, that's being generous, of them were struggling with some sort of mental thing.
That's the thing about it, isn't it? You'd be surprised if you weren't.
Yeah.
If you did tours of Afghanistan, Iraq, Ireland, if you did these tours, like, and you came back and you hadn't been affected, you'd be odd. Well, actually, you'd just be a psychopath. That's what you'd be. You know, like to not understand the emotive side of that. It is, yeah, that's what I always think. I think, yeah, you came home normal. That would be an odd thing for a human to do.
Yeah.
I love your overdraft analogy that you used earlier. It kind of relates to what Ben's saying about people who, you know, guys who had served for a long time. I think that's what you're, whether you're in the army or not, that's what you're doing, isn't it, effectively?
Yeah, and I don't...
You're drawing from an overdraft, but an overdraft that charges you interest. And as time goes on, the interest, which is the, obviously the price you pay for not dealing with your problems, just gets steeper and steeper and steeper.
Yeah, and then you can't pay it back. And I think, let's forget about the army for a minute, I think that's just normal life will put you under pressure. And you've got to manage. Manage is the wrong word, but you've got to address that at regular intervals. If you just go on ignoring your problems, you know, and I can talk openly. I got divorced, and that was because problems kept mounting, and I didn't deal with them. And you know, that's the normal thing. I didn't talk to people, didn't go out there, get help. You know, now I'm completely the opposite. You know, I need lots of help.
Don't shut up about it.
I come here in the gym and talk openly about my feelings.
What advice would you give to a man listening to this now who hasn't been able to open up in the past, who's struggling, has had that realisation that he's struggling, but he doesn't know what to do first? What would be your advice?
I think the first thing is to ask for help. And the thing to do there, the trouble with asking for help is, who do you ask?
Mm.
Asking your partner for help is the most obvious one, but that's the worst part of it, because your partner can't really, if you have a partner, that's another thing, if you don't have a partner, that's obviously even harder, but your partner's not really the person. You need to find someone, just that first person, to ask for help. And if you can't do that, there's lots of resources out there. You know, now it seems much more like you can reach out. There are issues, you know, GPs get knocked, but there is a service there, and you can get referrals if that's what you need, but you've got to ask someone.
Yeah, and I think also, like, if you're close to that person, you want to help them, and therefore you give advice, which is not the thing to do, as I've learned the hard way many a time. You know,
have you been? You've been giving advice.
I've been giving out advice with people, you know, who actually just want to be listened to.
That's it.
And they just want to be heard.
And that is a very male thing. I think men want to fix stuff. Want to fix stuff. So if someone tells, and I'm as guilty of that as anyone. If someone comes to me, I've got this going on, I'll immediately try and fix it.
Go to the gym. Do this. Do that.
Yeah, exactly. Whole list of...
No. Bugger off.
I now, talking about kind of reaching out to your partner as the first place to look, the first time I ever had therapy, my... then girlfriend, ex-girlfriend, booked me in for that first session.
Did she?
She took the step to contact somebody. She actually said, I've called Mind, the mental health charity, for you. They're going to call you back in 15 minutes on your number. And then it's up to you what you do with it. And it wasn't a particularly great relationship, but that was the best thing that she did for me.
And how did you find that first session when you went in there? Were you closed up and not talking, or did you go in and...
I think it all... flooded out of me, actually.
Yeah.
If I wasn't in the first session, in the second session, I was in floods of tears.
So that's great. But you see, that is like what you... I think what happens with men is you get an intervention, don't you? You get to the point, like your overdraft, right? You are now going bankrupt. That overdraft's unpayable, and there's a crisis. And that crisis can be relationship, violence, drugs. Breakdown.
Drugs is a big one.
Whatever. There will be a point where you've got so much pain, it just comes out, and it is not. You can't put a lid on it.
Yeah. So what we're wanting to do then, like us as Witterings Fitness, you talking on this podcast, setting up a men's group, is we want to catch men before they get to crisis point, don't we?
Yeah.
So that it doesn't require.
But I think of it. Mental health is just like normal health. You've got to do it regularly. Yeah. If you don't go to the gym or run or surf or whatever your sport is a couple of times a week, you're going to pay a price. Next time you try and work out, it'll be a lot harder. And mental health's the same. Mental health is go have a chat with someone. You know, you got stuff. Go and find a mate. Talk to them. You know, like we talked about these resources, like you talked about. What's that? It's Mind. It's a Mind.
Yeah, Mind. In terms of if anyone's listening and they are struggling and they don't know where to go and it's going to take them 2 or 3 weeks to see their GP, go to Mind, the mental health charity, because at least they'll have a conversation with you for free, and they will offer you some advice there and then. And if you go on to have cognitive behavioral therapy with them or something else, they're going to do that at a subsidized rate. So it's not completely free, but it's not what you pay a private therapist. And you don't have the reputational or the sort of quality worries you have finding an independent therapist.
Do you feel that men need to be doing something when they talk more so than women? I know that's a generalization, but that's something I've found is useful.
Well, all the best conversations working out our issues I've had with my dad are walking, not looking at each other.
Yeah, really.
and I'd say something about, because there's all sorts of therapists. So you talked about CBT, which is something actually go back. That's used a lot in the military, but that is where you sit and talk. And as a mate of mine said, he said, how many times do I want to go there and talk about when the bomb went off? There are other ways. You've got to find things that fit with you. So if you go and try one thing, doesn't work, that's not the end of the road. There are other therapists, other talking treatments. There's all sorts of stuff out there. Got to find the thing that works for you.
Yeah, because sometimes reliving the moment is not useful.
Yeah, that can be the pit.
That can be bad. I feel like we've actually knocked the military quite a bit in terms of mental health, and there's obviously an issue there. But actually, I don't know about you, but I feel that I've been more equipped to deal with stress in the business. So when it closed for COVID, that was very stressful, but I was actually able to deal with it and adapt.
I think what we've knocked is the sort of more traumatic side of it, isn't it? But actually, if the military is very good at is mindset, that you can achieve things. The military is all about building you up to achieve, that's it. And that mindset is great, for what you're talking about. I think it becomes a problem where you're not then getting help when you need it.
Yeah.
So you can be determined.
It's something, because you're exposed to a lot more extreme circumstances than you would be in civil life. Do you feel like that's the case for you, a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I did selection for the SAS and passed. So I think that set me. I think what it is self belief, isn't it? Sometimes you've got to look in the mirror and think, I can do this, and that's something everybody does can do. Everyone's got resources they don't know they can call on.
Mm.
You've got this ability. You must see it in the gym. Yeah. I mean, we sit here every day, don't we? People who think, I can't do that.
Yeah.
And then they can, because they have got it in them, because their body and mind has that ability. But the belief isn't there. And once the belief's there, world's your oyster.
Rory and I have made a couple of people cry in the past.
What is that by pushing them with heavy weights? Or just
Well, not so much. Just believing in them, whether they don't believe in themselves.
Yeah.
Actually.
Yeah.
And it's not like we're beasting them. Yeah. It's just like, you can do that pull-up. I believe you can do it. Yeah. And they're like, no, I can't. And then they do it. And then afterwards, they always come and say, thank you. It was amazing. I feel great now because I actually did something that I didn't think I could do.
I think we find out who we are as human beings, don't we, in adversity. And that requires us being pushed out of our comfort zone. And whether you're getting somebody to do a pull-up in the gym or at the kind of more extreme end of things, SAS selection, you're taking people out of their comfort zone. And most of us live in our comfort zone most of the time. And it's a less rich human experience. Okay, these things are challenging. Even back to the point you make about male mental health, and often men have to get to a crisis point. But we have kind of natural periods of life, don't we, where we're on a kind of downward trajectory or we're on an upward trajectory, and that you can't maintain this kind of balance is a little bit of a myth in that respect. You're always traveling in one direction or the other. And so I think the crisis is often desirable in a perverse way.
Well, I think
that you have to understand where bottom is and how you deal with that adversity and everything else to really understand what it is to be a human being.
Yeah, and I think there's this thing that obviously you don't want bad things to happen, but they are going to happen in your life. People will die in your lifetime. You will lose a job. You will have problems and all these challenges. And there's this phrase like, if you get enough pain, it will motivate you, If I'm that overweight, it will motivate. It's a motivator. You get to the point where you just go, yeah, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to smoke cigarettes anymore. I don't want to drink this much anymore.
I think, you know, the whole, like, men having, you know, I feel like there was a time in my life where I was kind of waiting for something terrible to go wrong. And then I think I realised that, why the fuck am I just waiting around for stuff to go horribly wrong? Like, I don't need something major to happen necessarily to make changes. I think that was quite a a moment, and I was like, oh, don't actually need to have a heart attack.
Well, you don't want to. You're a fit guy.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't that fit.
Were you?
No, I was actually too overweight to join the army. When I went to join, not by like, you know, miles and miles, but like I had to go and, you know, lose some weight. Dented my ego at the time quite a bit.
This point about kind of waiting for something to go wrong, though, Ben, I think it relates back to trying to catch people before their crisis, doesn't it? If we think to kind of what you want to do with the men's group, Thomas, about catching people before the crisis,
I think, and yeah.
Often there are, I understand where Ben's coming from. You get to a point, whether it's with smoking or alcoholism or drugs or debt or whatever it is, where you think, I'll do something about this when it's bad enough for me to do something about this.
Yeah.
This idea that you're going to put it off and you're going to wait till it's so bad and so terrible and then you'll take action.
Yeah, but that's the point of like talking to people, is you do it regularly. You don't, you head that off way before it becomes the issue, because you're talking regularly, and that's the maintenance rather than the, you know, we talked about the overdraft, then you're regularly topping up the bank balance. You're not going into overdraft because, you know, yeah, I've got a problem, but I just sat down and had a coffee with someone and it's, you know, I'm feeling better about that now. Just talking about it can make you, the problem's not going to go away, but talking about it can make you feel better about it.
I read a really useful book, which is, I think, perhaps slightly controversial nowadays. So Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus.
Yeah.
Have you read that? Have you read that one?
I've read it.
I've read it.
Thoughts? What did you think?
I mean, to be honest, it was a while ago.
Yeah.
So you're taxing my memory, Ben. But it makes intuitive sense.
Yeah.
Doesn't it? And I think
slightly sexist undertones, perhaps.
But we talked earlier, didn't we, about like who do you turn to first in a crisis? Oh, it's going to be your partner, and how men and women are different, and men want to problem solve. I'll say to my wife, if she comes to me with something, I'll say, would you like a solution or sympathy?
Mm.
And I remember reading in that book that actually a lot of female conversation, whether this is right or not, but it's something that stays in my mind, they're conversing with each other for sympathy. They're not trying to solve one another's problems, that it's enough to share the problem and not have to solve it. So I wonder sometimes when she comes to me, what role does she want me to play? Is it like a girlfriend who's sympathetic? Or is it the husband who needs to solve the problem?
You can say, what do you want from this?
Yeah.
I mean, and then the other thing is, and I think this is a statistic, but 70% of divorces are initiated by women. And I think it's because they're doing the thinking about stuff, and men are just plodding, you know, they keep your head down, get it, you know, get them, whatever the problem is, keep going. And then one day your wife turns up, goes, you know, this is over. And or your girlfriend goes, Rory, you're really annoying me. Sorry, mate. I'm sure she's lovely. She's never going to say that to me.
I've never heard it in the past, Tom. I'll probably never hear it in the future.
One of the things I really took from it was having a man cave.
Yeah.
You know?
But everyone's got one of those, haven't they?
The importance of a man cave. And how... and I realise it is actually really important. So, you know, I think there's a lot of pressure on men to talk.
Yeah.
And it is a good thing. But one of the things I took from that is that actually it's okay to go to your cave and work shit out in your head, and then when you're ready to talk, you go and do it.
But
if you're forcing, if you go into the cave and try and force the man to talk, that's one of the worst things.
Oh,
you
no,
can
never
do
that.
Never,
never
do that.
Never do that. Then you're probably with a big stick.
Yeah.
But you talked about men and talking and activity earlier.
Mm.
Yeah.
Like men tend to. We tend not to say, let's meet up and have a coffee. Let's meet up for lunch. We're going to go and play sport, or we're going to go to the gym, or we're going to get in the sea, or we're going to go and do something, or we're going to go
fix
to a football match or whatever it is.
But that's the same thing. It's so the reason I reckon, so that's the, uh, the man cave is a mobile feast. So the golf course is a kind of place where men meet up. You know, surfing for me, I don't know what you're worried about. You go on your
shed.
Now I'm talking about where you talk to other men, Ben. Like, okay, you probably don't talk to them when you're cycling, but like you go on a trip, like you're going to Cambodia.
I do. When I go cycling,
so you're going on Cambodia, like you're going to go on this charity trip, and you'll spend lots of time, you know, with other people. That's it. You're talking.
But a lot of it is unsaid as well with men. It's just about like spending time with other men where you know you could say something if you wanted to. And it's often, I think, in what's unsaid. I remember reading something about our evolutionary history. And like when we were hunter-gatherers, women would obviously stay in the village and they would talk while they were doing gathering and other tasks. Because you can't disturb a berry. So you can chat while you're doing
this
that.
This is now being so sexist. Wait. You can explain this.
But where, in terms of men and hunting, you had to have a lot of non-verbal communication. So you'd go out and you'd spend a lot of time together tracking animals and hunting, but you couldn't make a lot of noise.
But this is true, because my wife came on like surf trips with us, which she gave up doing because she goes, oh, what do you guys talk about? Comes on a trip.
Nothing.
No. There's very little chat. You're driving around in a car. There's some really bad jokes. Do a lot of accents. Laugh hysterically at rubbish jokes.
Yeah, it's just
and she just got fed up. She said, what is this thing you're doing?
But there's a so this is what, you know, when you mentioned this men's group earlier, I was like, you know, because I've been thinking about this. You know, there's a chemical thing, right? There's testosterone that men need and generally women need estrogen, and there's activities that produce testosterone.
Okay.
And so when we leave this room now, all of our testosterone levels will have gone up just by sharing this time together.
Is that true?
That's true.
I didn't know that.
And it's bad for a woman to produce testosterone.
Well, they need some.
They need some, but if it's too much, it will stress them.
Well, this is in marriages, the a woman in marriage extends the life expectancy of a man, whereas we reduce the woman.
Really?
This is what? This is bad science. Don't listen to these people. We're gaining some areas we do not know anything about. Yeah.
But I think there's, you know, there is something to be said for having activities for men. So when men, basically, and I know it's like not spoken about or almost taboo now, but need to do some sort of manly activity.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
and we don't say stuff like that anymore. Yeah. And I think, like, well, actually, this, you know, some people just need to fucking go and lift some weights.
Yeah, well, you see kids. So I've got two boys, 4 and 7. Their energy levels, and my girls are older. They're now in their teens. Their energy levels are off the chart, off the chart. I mean, and that is a physical reality. Mm. They need to burn some fuel.
Yeah,
we're talking about the physical reality of men, like 45, 50 years of age and upwards. The kind of the manopause is
manopause.
A thing. Men go through andropause, testosterone levels drop.
Mm.
And so if you look, this is happening to a man, his testosterone's dropping, which means he's much more likely to be depressed.
Erectile dysfunction, real thing.
Real thing, but
many people.
If you also look at the statistics around when a man is at his peak in terms of his career progression and the amount of money he earns, statistically, the top of that bell curve is 45. So you're topping out on average at 45 just as your testosterone levels are dropping.
Mm.
So now perhaps you've reached peak success and you're more depressed. And obviously as testosterone drops, you get more estrogen, so you hold more fat around your belly. And so now you're gaining weight, you're more depressed, and you might have peaked out professionally all of that happens at the same sort of age for a man.
Well, that's why I train here, because I didn't used to do much gym. I did a bit of gym, but like generally you find when you're younger, because you're doing sport, because you're doing other things, but once you cross that kind of 40, I'm now 56, I definitely have to work. If I didn't work out and train here, you know, I wouldn't probably surf as well. It's one of the things I focus on, is like I want to be out surfing. That's quite a hard sport. It's a very hard sport, you know, endurance, and you need a lot of flexibility and strength. And you lose that as you get older. I think, I don't know if this is true, but I think you don't lose endurance, which is interesting. So I think a lot of men focus on, doing a lot of endurance training.
Yeah.
And they're not backing that up with working out. You know, weights are important because it's good for your bone strength. It makes your bones stronger.
Yeah.
And that's something you lose as you get older. Muscle mass, you lose that very quickly. I've noticed that if I don't train, you know, your muscles get
and chemically you get the testosterone.
Yeah, and I get testosterone of Ben. I just suck it out of the system.
Tom, you're absolutely right. Some of the best endurance athletes in the world, male endurance athletes in the world, are over 35, 40, some of the best Ironmen in the world, because you don't lose it.
Yeah.
But that, in terms of muscle mass, as you age as a man, your testosterone drops, and testosterone triggers growth hormone in the body, so then growth hormone drops, and so yeah. then that but resistance training is.
I think, because I don't want, like, we're making Whitfit sound like it's a bit like a kind of
testosterone, you know, heavy.
It's not. That's not what this is about. You can start from a base level of nothing, and come to the gym, this gym, train, and you'll improve.
Yeah.
The improvements will be incremental and slow to start with, but you'll notice differences, and you'll just feel better if you train. If you take exercise a couple times a week, try and do as much as you can, but like 2-3 times a week, I definitely think that's a mental health, physical win. You know?
How long ago was your shoulder surgery, Tom?
I had it, May, end of May last year, June time. Yeah.
And now are you back to full fitness in the sea? When you
Yeah, full fitness in the sea. The only thing I can't do now is overhead with a bar. That's probably it. Yeah.
But what were you deadlifting last week?
I was 90
for 10.
10 reps. Yeah.
So that's a man there who's had a shoulder surgery, took a break from the gym for a good 2 months, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And so basically upper body, not zero, because you were in good nick anyway, but it was a setback, and now you're
deadlifting. That's something that I think your body... This is my theory, I don't know if this is true, but I think the fitter you are going into any trauma, whether it's surgery or whatever, the better your recovery will be, you know, it will be. And actually, I think people, now I think it's good actually with injury stuff, people get people moving with hip replacements more quickly than they used to, because the last thing you want to do after any, get back in, not the gym or lifting heavy weights, but just get moving. Mm-hmm. And we're great here because we've got the sea. So the moment I had the surgery, I was back in the sea. So cold water, moving around, it's summer, it's lying in the water, you know.
Yeah,
it's not just your theory, you're absolutely right. It's why when you're going for a major op, they tell you to
get moving,
not smoke for 6 months prior to the operation and things like that, so you can go in as fit as you can. Before Ben does his wrap up, there's another book in the offing, isn't there, Tom?
There is.
Do you want to punt your original book first?
This first book, Speed, Aggression, Surprise, is the secret origins of the SAS. It's about the Second World War in North Africa, which people will know a bit about if they've seen the SAS Rogue Heroes Peaky Blinders series on BBC. You know, Peaky Blinders in the Sand. That's that one. So my book's a bit of a more in-depth look at that and a wide look at that. And my second book is going to be, which I can plug, I haven't written the thing yet, but I'm pitching it at the moment. It's actually that the modern SAS did not come from that story. It came from where you're going, where Cambodia and around there.
Oh, right.
It came from Southeast Asia because the SAS disbanded in 1945,
okay,
but was reformed in 1950 in the jungles of Malaya. And that's where Tutu, the modern SAS, come from.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Where you're going to go.
So many questions, but we haven't got time.
Yeah, we haven't got time. We'll come on again. We'll do another one. Yeah. Anyway, that's not totally relevant to our...
It's all good. All good stuff. And I was just thinking there, you know, going back to what we were talking about earlier, and I think it's more manly to face up to your problems and talk about them than it is to bury them.
Absolutely.
Mm. You know, that's more... To me, that's more manly. That's courage and confidence.
Yeah, but that's changing a whole societal thing, you know, a whole idea that you can talk to other people, which is men's group, things like that.
Yeah.
Help.
It's how you define bravery, isn't it?
Yeah.
Awesome. Right, we went all over the place there, but thanks, Tom.
Thanks,
appreciate
Ben.
You taking the time out to chat to us.
That's okay. Anytime, guys.
Anytime. See you later. Thank you.
Thanks very much.